We get the hour underway by welcoming in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Good day to you, Mr. Fleming.
How is it going, Sir Richard?
Well, it's going okay up here. It sounds like you've got we got people crowding your running areas when you're trying to get your exercise in.
You know me, I'm a Zulu warrior, and I feel like you should be able to lower your shoulder and make running, make stair climbing more competitive and pop people out of the way. But people have found I've been running stairs to Boston College now that my beloved obelisk is closed, and people have discovered my stairs. Like when the birds all figure out this new bird feeder, and like, ooh, this is great, free seed. So I'm there running the other day, and people, they like to bond with you. They're like, way to go, man. Way to work it. Guy's like sitting on a bench, and he's like sucking wind, and I'm thinking like, you are weak, sir. I've destroyed you. But I don't say that. I just think it, and I hope that it registers in my eyes.
Oh, I'm sure it does. I have no doubt about that. Well, we got a lot of ground to cover, as always, today. And let's start with Michael Jordan, the subject of a recent sort of documentary, skewed a little bit because of the involvement of Michael Jordan. But where would you like to begin with MJ, as I like to call him?
I thought that you were going to bring that up, but you, the way you spoke about it before, it made me think that you had other points as well. You had some, I wanted to hear your Jordan insight.
Well, my insight is...
like they might not be very rosy.
Just that I found myself... Well, initially, I didn't have much interest in the documentary series because I never found Jordan to be particularly interesting beyond his greatness as a basketball player because he didn't say much. But I watched, and I watched more as it went on, and I came out of it feeling sad for him, feeling like this was kind of an empty vessel who made the sacrifice he had to make to be the greatest player ever, but still seems to carry around a lot of that anger and bitterness that fueled him. And I wonder if there's any peace in Michael Jordan's world.
I felt sad for myself when I watched it because I was thinking that he's supposed to be so competitive. And I'm thinking to myself, you're a lot more competitive than this guy. He just wants to beat people. You want to end people in your particular profession. And I understand how that can drive some people away, even some people that at some point are on your side. And I think it's a question, it's a problem, it's a burden of to the person to whom much is given, which is part of the equation. And the second part of the equation of greatness is how hard you're going to work to hone what you've been given. And Orson Welles is the same way. He had a problem suffering fools and would browbeat people. He's a nice man. He's a really, truly a kind man, a deeply kind man. And I don't know if that's the case with Jordan. I think he's maybe a better person than I thought he was when I saw his relationship with his family and his mother and the kind of person she was. To me, she was kind of a standout individual in the entire documentary, and it didn't get much mention. But when you have that much more ability than everyone else, and you're that driven, they tend to work in tandem, the ability you're given and the drive that goes along with it. And a lot of people in this world, more so now even than during Jordan's time, they don't understand what it means to have purpose. They don't understand, like when everyone says, I'm a writer, like, well, you're not up at 4:07 on a Sunday morning like I am writing 3,000 words before you walk literally 20 miles and run 1,000 stairs so you can keep your heart in the shape it needs to be in to keep doing this. That's drive. I get that. So other people tend not to have that. One out of 70 million people might have that. Jordan had that for basketball, and I think it alienated some people, but they achieved things that they never would have come close to on his own. And I think he's at peace with who he is as a person, as a talent, and as someone who evolved as a player. You mentioned that he didn't say that much. That's a lot of athletes, though. That's a lot of great athletes that still remain fascinating. Wayne Gretzky didn't say that much. He had a mind like Aristotle, right, for the game of hockey. Bobby Orr didn't say that much. And lots of people, Brady, didn't say that much. Jordan said more than those particular athletes. And then you have people who just never stop talking, never stop tweeting, never stop posting. So I think the issue that Jordan's production company was involved was a thorny one, and it was certainly skewed not so much to his success, making him look like the hero of the piece, but I think other voices were left out of the documentary as a result of the sort of through line of Michael Jordan. And there were other through lines that could have maybe been up there at the same, not the same level, but at least a comparable level.
So if you have that talent, that unique talent, that unique drive, is it possible to have that and still have healthy personal relationships, or is it an either-or situation?
I couldn't work with other people wanting to be writers. I would make you want to never write again. I'd make you not want to be alive the next day. It wouldn't just be enough for me to beat you. And for people that were on my team, to a degree, I'd have to keep them at a distance because I would just get too frustrated. It would drive me out of my mind trying to always come down to somebody else's level. And that's what something that's far more complicated than a sport, but I can understand how he would have felt that way. And people will say, Bill Russell didn't need to drive people away to lead and win championships. But if you look at the people that Bill Russell was playing against, they weren't. It was a whole different breed of athlete. That Jordan in that era would have won 15 straight championships. So I don't know that you can really compare that. Jordan did do it in one of the hardest periods to win in any sport in North American sports history. I think like the Edmonton Oilers of the 83-84 team, the 76-77 Canadians were just the best hockey teams ever. But they weren't doing it against the level of competition that those Bulls were doing it. And the Bulls wouldn't have done it without Pippen, who is, when he wanted to be, maybe the best defender in the history of the league from one end of the floor to the other. I don't think people really, when those Bulls teams were struggling, people think of them as an offensive team. They turned on that full court press, and it was the most smothering thing I've ever seen in sport. And that's what they generated their offense off of. And I was surprised that the docuseries didn't make more of that. But there's greatness that you can have when you are given that gift. But there are also things that just aren't that much fun. That's why people talk about the tragic life of the artist. I think there was artistry to what Jordan did, and it's a heavy weight. It's a weight that can pay off, and something I would imagine he wouldn't wish to trade, or Beethoven wouldn't wish to trade. But that doesn't mean like the personal component of it in terms of your relationships is easy.
They're talking about doing a similar piece on Tom Brady. Do you have any interest in that? And is he an interesting enough guy to give us whatever it is, 9-10 hours?
I think Brady has become more brand than man. And I think he is a model for how you don't want to be right now. I don't think he has a cognizance in terms of what's happening in the world around him. I think he's had such a remove from it. And he just keeps shoving his brand, force-feeding you that brand. I think, like, how much money do you need? How much narrative do you need to control? Let things be. There is an art to letting things be what they are and emerging in time. And Jordan did do that with this series. It was long after he was playing. If I was a Tampa Bay Buccaneers fan and I got over my initial, like, woohoo, Brady's on the squad, sort of zeal, I think this guy, he hasn't even taken a snap for us yet. And he's orchestrating, because you know he wants the control. You know he's going to be like the de facto producer with veto power. He's trying to set the record straight, I feel like, with the whole New England Belichick, especially the Belichick component saga. It's like, dude, just let it go. People are doing all kinds of crazy things in the world right now. The world's kind of gone to hell. Back off with your brand. Play for this team. Go away for a while. Write a memoir. Something. But don't see Jordan doing it and saying, you know what? I'm going to do one too. I'm Brady. It's off-putting to me.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. Well, let's move from great athletes to science fiction. One of my favorites from the mid to late 1950s, The Blob.
Yes, it's great. With Steve McQueen, as a high school kid pushing 30. And the McQueen is going to be in Wanted, Dead or Alive. Great, great series, really. And one of the better things that he did. And The Blob was not very well received critically. And it hasn't ever really fared that well, like, retrospectively, critically. Always kind of been panned, which is strange, because it's a fun film. And It's a gorgeous looking film. It's just in terms of the colors of it, even in that great explosion of colors of the films of that era, it stands out. And McQueen, it's funny because, like, you wouldn't think to watch this film that he's going to be this, like, pretty reputable actor. His direction must have consisted of, and now you'll notice if you watch it, people out there, okay, Steve, think. Like, you actually just see him, like his girlfriend asked him a question, and he holds, like, the thinking pose for, like, 20 seconds. And then she's like, Steve, his name is Steve in the film, too. And he's just, like, kind of doing this weird, I don't know if it's, like, method acting, but he's like, okay, I'm really going to think. Like, it accrues, too. It ends up becoming, like, 4.5 minutes of this not very long film, but there's this classic sequence, right, with the blob. It gets bigger and it gets darker as it goes along, and it's at the movie theater, and it comes out of where the projector is and all that. But it's funny, there's an interesting little mistake on the marquee of the film where they go to the spook show. It mentions Daughter of Horror, which was a retitled film. The film was called Dementia. It's really just a very odd film. It got like this X rating and was banned for a while. And so that was 1957. And it says also that Bela Lugosi is showing up. Only problem was, Lugosi had been dead for a while, so that wouldn't have been possible. So that really would have been this spook show. But it's kind of that synthesis of horror, sci-fi, teen romance film, detective story. It's a lot of things at once, and I think that makes it fun. And it has a great, there's a 10-hour looped version of the theme song by Burt Bacharach, which is just, It's beware of the blob. It creeps and leaps. It's just like it's in my head. Once it's in your head, it's like it is there in blob-tastic form today.
And I saw it, I think, in the best place to see it first time around when I was in high school. I think I saw it at a drive-in, and it was great at the drive-in.
Oh, it's like a quintessential, and I kind of like this idea of like drive-in coming back because to me, it's like we've talked about, I'll leave the light on for you, like motels and kitschy motels. There's like a romanticism. I think there's a romanticism to the drive-in that I've always liked. That in some ways, they're more magical in your mind than they are, like when you go to one and the sound's all tinny and everything. But it is the perfect sort of drive-in. It's not about the movies, but it feels kind of like it's about the movie-going experience. Mm. That's why this like balcony that they're in at the movie theater is so central the plot. When Steve McQueen and his girlfriend, they go up there to get the gang to help them figure out this mystery of what is landed and is doing up people. And it's almost like an homage to Rebel Without a Cause, but it's like a much toned down, it's like a family friendly Rebel Without a Cause, whereas James Dean is doing this whole existential howl thing that Steve McQueen is certainly not going to be doing in the blog.
All right, we move from the blob to the 200th anniversary of Keats, The Eve of St. Agnes.
Yes, we cover some ground, and this is a poem that Keats wrote in 1819, which is the last year that he's really going to write significant amounts of verse because he's not going to live much longer. He's going to struggle with his TB throughout 1820. And that's going to take him to the finish line. But some of the poems that he wrote in 1819 are coming out in 1820, and this is one of them. And it is this poem whose basis is this legend that Keats was kind of a randy guy, but like a classic randy guy. His publishers were always like, dude, what's going on here? He's like, this is kind of like poetry. It's like, oh, come on, I'm Keats. I get the TB. Let me just finish off with some salacity. And they're like, no, take this out. But the legend was that a female virgin would go to bed at night after like this revelry is all transpiring in her house. And she'd lay atop the bed naked. And she would look up at the sky with her feeling. And she would eventually see a vision of the guy who was going to marry her. And that would be awesome. But this one guy, this rake, he's there, and like he bribes like this woman, the servant woman's like, oh, come on, man, tell me where Madeline's room is. And she's like, I shouldn't, but I will, because she's so convincing. So he goes, he hides in the dresser, and he just does his peeping Tom routine. He's like, this is getting fine. This is excellent. Meanwhile, there's all this revelry, drunken revelry downstairs, drowning out, like, his lustful thoughts. And lo and behold, she sees him. He's like, oh, hey, you caught me. Oh, you're naked there. What are you going to do? I'll get in bed. We'll cuddle. She goes, okay, that's not so bad. And they fall in love. And it works out. And they leave. And they step over all these drunken bodies. And it's just this, it's kind of like a funny way of putting it. But it ends up being quite this touching, it's all written in these Spenserian stanzas. And if you were a poet at the time, you would have looked at this and thought, I can't match this guy's technique. You might even say that Keats was the Jordan of the Romantic poet. And this is a poem that really attests to that.
All right. And finally, we want to talk about some more great live music. I know you love, you've talked many times about the great BBC sessions and a terrific one featuring the Yardbirds.
Yes, there's a 3-CD set that recently came out at the end of last year. And it's the most comprehensive yet of the Yardbirds BBC recordings. And the thing with the Yardbirds is they left a couple of live albums. Well, really just one live album. Well, maybe two. Five Live Yardbirds was with Eric Clapton. It was before they did For Your Love and before they were famous. And they had one at the end of their career with Jimmy Page from a place called the Anderson Theater, which we talked about years ago in this program, was like kind of this proto Led Zeppelin thing. But their best incarnation was with Jeff Beck. And you can make an argument that it wasn't Jimi Hendrix who was the best guitarist of the 1960s. You could say that it was Jeff Beck. Now, I'm not saying that you'd be right, but you could make a pretty good case of that. But we don't really have that much that Beck did in the live format with the Yardbirds, save when they would go to the BBC studios. And they would do these versions of their songs, I Wish You Would, Heartful of Soul. They did a cover of Smokestack Lightning and the guitar, and it's just phenomenal. And also these covers that you wouldn't really get anywhere else with the Yardbirds. They do Freddie King's The Stumble. They do a John Lee Hooker song, or they base their version on his version of Bottle Up and Go. And they even do Hushabye, which is a kind of nursery lullaby type of song. And the guitar and the band, they are just a band that could hang as an ensemble, as players, with a great jazz band. I mean, this band was so good in how they interacted with each other and how they played. They're like the Stones, the Beatles. They couldn't really hang with the Yardbirds when the Yardbirds got it going on stage. Now, the Who would be able to, but not many bands ever. And if you just want to hear a band interact with each other and hear how tight their sound can be, but so progressive, so modernistic, because Beck is bending notes, he's using distortion. He's not just utilizing feedback, he's controlling feedback, which shouldn't be, like, scientifically possible. Hendrix could do it, and Jeff Beck can do it. And you can hear him do it on this amazing BBC set.
Hey, while you're here, Colin, good timing. Breaking news from the National Hockey League that the NHL has approved a playoff plan. Commissioner Gary Bettman says they've approved a plan for the league to return with 24 of the 31 teams jumping straight into the playoffs. The Bruins will play in one of two to-be-determined hub cities and will play in a round-robin format with three other teams, Tampa Bay, Washington, and Philadelphia, to figure out playoff seeding. Does this sound like a good idea to you?
I would have nixed all the sports because I think you're going to end up with a false positive for whoever wins the Cup, whoever wins Major League Baseball. But I like the novelty of the 24-team playoff. Think about this. Like, you're the Chicago Blackhawks. You were out of the playoffs before. Now it's like, hey, and it's like, things happen in life. I always thought, like, okay, my team's not in it, but something like tragic would have to happen for my team to come back, which is like a really grim way of thinking, like something happens to somebody's bus or whatever. But those kind of things, every century or whatnot, they do happen. So you're a team that's out of it. You're just playing out the string, seeing what you have for next year. And now you have a chance. And I think that could be a really fascinating narrative. What if a team like the Blackhawks, because you know how the playoffs work, hot goalie, couple stars, right? A third line plugger all of a sudden develops a scoring touch. And hey, we've moved through a couple rounds. I think that would be really interesting. I like those kind of Steve Penny, Montreal Canadiens, 1984 upset stories. Now you have more possibilities for that.
There you go. It's Colin Fleming. Check out his work, colinflemingLit.com. A wonderful buffet of awesomeness again this week. Thank you, Mr. Fleming.
Okay, thank you, sir.